House Committee on Revenue for Tuesday, May 15th, 2007 will come to order. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2530 and hear briefly from Senator Morris on an amendment. Paul, did you want to describe the amendment, or should we let Senator Morris do that?
Senator Morris said he had given us the draft asked counsel to draft, and this is it as the dash two.
And let me just say, committee, that there's a couple of minor glitches in the amendment, and we either what I'd like to do is roll the actual work on the bill over to tomorrow, or until when we get the corrected draft. Please, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, representing District 8, Albany and Corvallis. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill forward and to hold it in work session today. I would be delighted if we were working the original bill, but we're not at that point. There's a lot of discussion that needs to happen within this assembly and outside of this assembly in the state of Oregon, addressing the issue of tax reform, fundamental revenue restructuring in our state. What this amendment does is it essentially guts and stuffs the original bill with a task force that is very broad in its composition, reaching out to many, many stakeholders and engaging in a process over time with the state of Oregon to craft solutions to the problems that are confronting us today with our current revenue structures, not only within the state of Oregon in our general fund, but also within rural Oregon with the loss of the federal timber payments, bringing that discussion in to look at systemic reform for the entire state. What you have before you is the creation of a task force. It has a number of members. It would require this these solutions, if you may, to be delivered prior to the beginning of the 09 regular session. So it's an ongoing process that would begin upon passage and would conclude with the 09 session. So, Mr. Chairman, colleagues, the amendments that you have suggested, I'm in complete agreement with, to increase the legislative participation in the task force from two from the House, two of the Senate, to increase it to four from the House and four from the Senate. So I'm in agreement with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Morris while we're here? You've set up a structure with two bodies. One is the task force, and the other is a advisory council.
Yes.
And it appears to me as though your intent is to bring in as much as possible all the various groups of people who may have for whom the tax system of the state of Oregon may be important, including, as I see it, as I see here, the counties and other local governments, cities, because a comprehensive reform would require a change in the way they collect their revenue as well.
Yes, it's a very, very inclusive. The intent was to be very inclusive, Mr. Chair, in this process. You'll notice that the group is fairly large, but the task force itself is fairly small in terms of voting members, but you have surrounding this group the same kind of concept that we had that worked really quite well, and Representative Berger participated, as did I, on the Oregon Oregon
Innovation Council.
Innovation Council. Thank you. Too many acronyms floating around. And we had a lot of participation in that, and it was a very successful undertaking. And that would be the intent of this, is to reach out and be quite inclusive.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a thank you, Senator Morris, for bringing this amendment and your comments on that. And this is a comment. I absolutely share the sentiments that you voice, which is I wish we were working, 2530 without the amendments. Mr. Chair, if we were working 2530 without the amendments, the issues that we've embraced this session, including healthy kids, how to pay for state troopers, how to pay for our education system, would be taken care of at the same time that we're reducing the tax burden, increasing and improving the investment environment in Oregon. But apparently that'll be a later year. So I thank you for bringing this amendment, because if we can't do that this session, at least we can get our arms around it and hopefully be in a better position to do it next session.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Representative, no.
Yes.
Representative Burton?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will take this opportunity to applaud Senator Morris for keeping this ball rolling to broaden the audience, broaden the scope, and not let the ideas embodied here in a total restructuring, that's what I mean by those ideas, to either go away or not keep moving forward. There's a lot of talk about 2530 being the bill, but it's not the bill. It's part of a package, and I think that needs to be stated and restated again. It's not about a consumption tax. It's about how we tax and spend in Oregon, and that's what we need to be talking about totally. So thank you, Senator Morris.
Thank you, and I would simply add to that this is really about the issue of how we provide basic public services for Oregonians. And in the time that I've been here in the legislature, it's become completely obvious to me that the prosperity of our future generations and the education of the people who are not even born yet will be dependent in no small part on whether or not we're actually able to get to a tax reform package that will provide adequate basic budget for providing basic services at the state level, at the county level, at the city level, at local district levels, so that the really basic things that our government must do in order for the economy to operate are actually done. And that's what I think this is about, and I really appreciate Senator Marsh, you and the other members we heard from earlier, for bringing this bill and for proposing this amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And there are quite a number of legislators that have invested themselves in this process as well. I just happen to be the one to appear today in this work session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we appreciate it. And with that, colleagues, we need a small amendment to the amendment, which we're going to ask for. And if we get it back tomorrow, we'll work the bill tomorrow. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the work session with the understanding that we may reopen it tomorrow if we have that amendment.
And staff will ask for the amendment.
Yes. Yes, thank you. And with that, we're ready to do our public hearing, open a public hearing on House Bill 3488. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3488 modifies the business energy tax credit for facilities that use or produce renewable energy or manufacture renewable energy equipment from 35% to 50%. The current 35% is taken over 5 years in a 10-10-5-5-5 manner. The 50% would be front-loaded, so there would be 15% in the first 2 years, and then 10%, and then 5% in the last 2 years. The bill also requires the Department of Energy to establish criteria for qualifying facilities. It increases the residential energy tax credit for domestic water heating from $1,500 to $3,000, and for solar electric systems from $1,500 to $3,750. The bill also allows the public utilities to provide no-interest loans to customers who install renewable energy generation facilities in their homes, and it applies to facilities and devices acquired, erected, constructed, or installed on or after January 1, 2007, and to tax use beginning on or after January 1, 2007. And the last thing I did want to point out to the committee, in the bill, I think is what's an unintended consequence. On page 6, lines 37 and 38, I believe the intent of the amendment is to sunset the $1,500 credit for domestic water heating, and then in lines 39 through 40, it creates the $3,000 credit. So that's how it's modified from $1,500 to $3,000. But as I read the language in sub C, it would also sunset the credits for space heating, cooling, and electrical energy. So that might be an issue that the committee wants to take up as you hear the bill. There's also a retroactive piece there. It would sunset it for before January 2007.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Scott Bruin, representing House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. It's my pleasure to be here. It's the second time I've testified on House Bill 3488, which I co-sponsor with Representative Witt as well as Representative Dingfelder and Hanna. The genesis of this bill, there's the representative right there. The genesis of this bill was a sort of a quick work group that happened this last fall, fall 2006, which was me calling up Jeremiah Bauman basically and saying, actually it was started with Sybil, didn't it? Started with Sybil Ackerman, though LCV, but calling, talking to her on the phone and saying, you know what, this new California legislation is outstanding, and the California legislation was some comprehensive solar energy legislation that they enacted last year, and me trying to find a way to sort of work that into sort of the Oregon model. And so that led to Sybil talking to Jeremiah, which led to Jeff and John, and we had a work group, and from that we some ideas germinated, which after a lot of months and a lot of, you know, give and take has resulted in House Bill 3488. I will not go into the detail of the bill because these three gentlemen are much better capable of doing that than I, but let me just preface it in broad terms. House Bill 3488 is designed to give a leg up, if you will, to sort of our nascent solar energy industry. It does two things, basically. It encourages homeowners to install solar energy systems, and solar energy systems I've discovered are very expensive. I mean, the average residential solar energy system is an upwards of $20,000 to $25,000. So it's not something you do on a whim. We have a current tax credit structure for solar energy. The problem is it doesn't really get at much of the cost. It makes an effort, and you do what you can pay for, but by our analysis, and more importantly the industry's analysis, it's not enough to really encourage the use of solar energy where it wouldn't have been done in the first place. It's a nice thing for it's almost like the adoption tax credit, I realize. People are going to adopt anyway, but having the adoption tax credit sort of makes a nice little deal at the end. That's sort of the same situation as with solar energy right now. What 3488 is designed to do is to sort of make that a little bit more, a little bit broader, so we can encourage some folks that wouldn't otherwise look to install solar energy systems in their house. We can encourage them to do so. That's the one aspect. The second aspect, and an aspect that motivates me, and I know that Representative Reed and I had a bill that sort of looks at a similar issue, is that this will really do a lot, in my opinion, to jumpstart the Oregon solar energy industry. I would really like to see solar energy, as well as all renewable energies, but specifically solar energy, become a real, have Oregon be a real mecca for solar energy. And this bill will get us a long way there. There's a lot of advantages that Oregon currently has within the tech world to be able to sort of be that mecca for solar energy industries, and this is one more step to get us there. So I encourage the committee to give this a good hard look. I think it's a great thing for Oregon, both for Oregon industry and for the Oregon environment, and I hope you will give it a favorable look. And with that, I would introduce the three J's that will John Miller, Jeff Bichonette, and Jeremiah Bauman, who can talk on the detail of the bill. And I will exit the stage.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, clean energy businesses, faith groups, and labor. The Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association is a member of the coalition, and the coalition has kind of been doing the spade work on this bill in conjunction with the association with the solar industry. John Miller, the director of the association, is going to kind of take you through the details of the bill. I'll just kind of go maybe one or two levels down from Representative Bruhn. We basically wanted to kind of take a look at some of the business energy and residential energy tax credit and finding out some of the price tags for some of our proposals. We're really wanting to kind of focus on the residential energy tax credit because that seems to be maybe a little bit more in line with current financial realities for the state. Also, John will talk a little bit more about a particular a new financing mechanism for renewable energy systems, and so if the committee decides it wants to sort of move ahead with this bill, we'll be looking to bring back an amendment that would provide a property tax exemption for on-site renewable energy systems that currently don't exist, and so there is no revenue impact. And then we're basically asking the state to forego any revenue impact that might come from that. But again, John will cover that in more detail. And then thirdly, based on Chris's introduction, I did want to say that the piece that he highlighted on page 6 was indeed an unintended drafting error. And so, again, if the committee wants to go forward with the bill, we would bring back an amendment to make sure that we're a little bit more surgical in the sunset, or what we're proposing to sunset. With that, I'll introduce John Miller with the Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a group of small business contractors, energy professionals, distributors, and manufacturers such as Solar World that are a part of the industry here in Oregon. So I'm here speaking obviously in favor of Senate Bill or House Bill 3488, and for very good reasons. We are part of one of the fastest growing industries in the world, in the solar industry. We're sitting right on top of the third largest market in the world in California with their solar industry. So as Representative Bruhn explained, to remain competitive in that market, one of the things that we need to do is raise some of these credits for the solar industry. And it actually, for the PV, as Jeff was saying, we looked at some of the financial costs, and we think that $9,000 is probably the optimum number for the PV credit, drawing that down from the original proposal in the bill. And that ties into the current language in the Betsy 2211. So it fits in with that as well. And the $3,000 for the solar hot water. And I wanted to make sure that you understood that the residential, the Betsy credits that we're doing this year are great. They're going to help out the industry here and keep us competitive in Oregon. There's no doubt about that. But we cannot forget about the residential market. It's an important part of the solar market in particular. It's probably around 50% of the market in mature, in where solar is mature in places like Germany and Japan and so forth. So it's definitely an important part of the market. And with solar hot water in particular, it's important that we don't leave it behind. The increase we're asking for solar hot water is very important. It's one of the most cost-effective solar installations we can do today, and it's growing. It never gets the exposure that solar PV gets, the solar electric industry gets, but it's definitely one of the best solar applications that we can do, and it's growing very rapidly across the world. 33 million installations in China, 100,000 a year in Germany, and so forth. So we did 8,000 total in the United States last year. So we have a lot of ground to make up in the U.S., and we're now seeing these manufacturers come to the U.S. I'm seeing them from Germany. I'm seeing them from China and other places come to really pick up the hot water industry here in the States. And currently, Oregon is fifth in the United States. So we are doing very well in solar hot water, but we've got a lot of room to grow there. With the property tax exemption, the current property tax exemption is good. The problem that we're seeing right now is a new financing model coming in for the solar industry, and that financing model pulls in investments from out of state. So it's important that we what's happening right now is that the current exemption excludes some of these investment decisions from going forward, from getting these new, actually this applies to the commercial systems mostly. So right now, the current exemption would exclude this new model, financing model, from taking place and installing these. And as Jeff said, there's none of these exist in the state today because we haven't seen them. This is a financing model very similar to the one we've seen for wind, for the community wind and so forth. And now the solar industry is just starting to incorporate this. So this tax credit would apply to the systems that are installed on site and for use on site. That's the primary intent of the exemption that we're seeking for that. So that's the end of the testimony that I have.
We'll ask questions in a minute, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Osberg, Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, in support of House Bill 3488. Representative Broom covered it very well. There are a number of reasons that solar technology in particular is a very good technology for Oregon and a big opportunity for Oregon to reap both the environmental and economic benefits of this particular renewable energy technology. I'll touch on them just briefly, give a little bit more context for this bill. One is simply that Oregon has a tremendous solar energy resource. We might have a reputation in the rest of the country as a rainy state, but even our rainiest places actually have better sunlight than Germany, which is the world leader in solar power right now. Secondly, you get solar power kind of combines the benefits of renewable energy and energy conservation, which is the generally the cheapest and fastest way to cut our dependence on fossil fuels, and is it makes good fiscal sense. And that's simply because when you have the electricity being generated on people's rooftops, that means there's less need for transmission and distribution lines, and it's that transmission when electricity moves long distances where you lose a lot of that electricity. And then finally, it cuts the demand for electricity at the peak of the summer. It's right in the hottest days when people's air conditioners are kicking in. When we are starting in Oregon to now see our peak electricity usage, solar kicks in right at the same time and reduces the need for utilities to add generation. PacifiCorp has been for several years now trying to get approval to build two coal-fired power plants in Utah, partially to serve Oregon customers, but their primary need is actually only for peak energy generation in the summertime. So the more we can reduce that, the more we reduce the need for major new power generation investments and reduce rates and bills overall. Let me just comment very, very briefly on the policies in this bill. First of all, as a point of context, Representative Broom referred to the major California legislation on solar. To give you a little bit of an idea of how major that legislation in California was, California decided to invest $3 billion over 10 years in solar incentives. That's about $300 million each year. We're not proposing that Oregon match that investment this year. Per capita, that would be about the same as Oregon giving $30 million. We're also not proposing that we invest quite that much. This bill rather increases a targeted set of tax credits with a total cost, my understanding, is of about $2 million. And with some of the changes we're suggesting today, we could bring that down to $1.2 million. The primary point that I would make in terms of changes that could be made, the current bill has a $15,000 tax credit for a residential energy tax credit. I think a $9,000 makes sense for one very specific reason, which is the business energy tax credit bill that this committee and the full House has already approved. Gives a $9,000 tax credit for home builders and developers who put the solar technology in before the house is sold, which we think makes a lot of sense. There are good economic reasons to do it at that point in the construction phase, even if there's not a homeowner yet, and that's a smart incentive. But we also think that the homeowner should be getting at least the same tax credit that a developer or a home builder would when they make the choice themselves, especially because, if anything, it's financially more difficult for the homeowner to do it. And then I'd also make a similar point that John made. Solar hot water technology in particular is much closer to being an easier financial investment. It's much cheaper than solar electric technology, and so a little bit of an increase there, a total cost of about $600,000 or $700,000 for that, increase to $3,000 in the tax credit, which would make a big difference for Oregonians being able to use that technology that's even more universally applicable and available. And then I'll just close by noting that I'd be certainly happy to continue working with Representative Broom and Representative Witt, as well as Representative Reed, it sounds like, on looking at other ways that we can be advancing solar technology more comprehensively in Oregon. My guess is at this date that probably means for next session, but I certainly urge the passage of this bill as a good first step.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes,
I do have a question. I realize it's not necessarily the purview of the Revenue Committee, but we've had this debate ongoing about Senate Bill 838 and the Renewable Portfolio Standard. Does this in any way play into that? Will this, I mean, 838, you know, the utilities have to, you know, have 25% renewable by 2025. This is obviously energy produced at the home. Okay, will it count toward that 25 by 25, or is it, or will it not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, the energy produced from solar energy will count towards the 25% by 2025 requirement. This bill is actually a very good companion to that bill, partially because what you'll see is a general renewable energy standard where utilities have a requirement to buy renewable energy. They're not going to choose solar very often. It's more expensive than wind and some of the other technologies like geothermal and biomass. And also, frankly, it's because it's on people's homes, which is a lot better for consumers and the energy system overall, it also doesn't make utilities all that comfortable because they don't have a whole lot of control over it when it's not something they're owning and in control of when it's generating and where it's going. So this, I think, this helps more solar energy meet a higher portion of that of Senate Bill 838's targets in the standard. I should probably note by way of context, other states that have renewable energy standards have actually required that a portion of the renewable energy standard be met with specific technologies like solar, partially because of the many stakeholders involved in that process, from industrial customer groups to utilities and others. We've avoided a sort of secondary requirement that certain technologies play certain roles, but we think it's also important to make sure that technologies like solar have the incentives so that they do play a role in helping us get to that statewide goal.
And I could just add, Chair, I think you mentioned it in there, but the utilities can buy the green tags from these systems, and that's how it would fit in with them offsetting their the 838 deal. And it also fits in with the new net metering that's coming out this year as well. So there's a lot of good policy that's coming in that this fits right in with.
Thank you. Earlier on, Mr. Miller, you talked about the new financing model that's being used for wind. Could you describe that just a bit more?
Well, what happens is typically the owners of these systems can't afford to buy them, and that includes both wind and solar. So what they do is they go out and they find investors that can afford to buy them. And so they leverage those investor money to come in, buy these systems, and finance these systems to get them into the ground. And so what these investors can also do is they have a tax appetite, so they can utilize the tax credits from the federal. And that's a big deal in both the wind and the solar, because a lot of the entities don't have that big of a tax appetite, so that we can pull these investment dollars outside of Oregon into Oregon to finance these systems in both wind and solar. But that's kind of the model that's being done, and it hasn't been used so often with solar in the past. It is pretty typical and standard with the wind industry at this point.
Okay, and I think you said that there was a problem with the current law in Oregon that makes that more difficult?
Yeah.
Or did I misunderstand that? Would you describe what that is?
Yeah, it's actually there is an exemption right now, a property tax exemption that so no solar electric systems are essentially being it doesn't affect them, and that's been in place for a long time, and that's been good, and it's helped the solar industry to install more of these systems. But there's a section in that 307.175 that it exempts those investors from coming in and getting involved with the on-site generation systems from PV. So it actually prevents those investors, that investor model, from happening in the solar industry. And what we're asking is to include those investor models for these solar, for the on-site generation ones.
Okay. Is that in this bill?
It is not yet.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is not yet. It was something that came up, an issue that was sort of identified after this bill kind of got moving, and then a lot of people said, hey, here's something, a need that needs to be addressed. And so, several people came up and said, you know, would you be willing to let this bill be used as a vehicle for this idea. Specifically, just there are a couple of specific examples. The city of Portland, for instance, is looking to do a fairly large system, I think, to heat some city pools or that sort of thing. There's also a nonprofit organization called the Bonneville Environmental Foundation that is looking to have these larger type systems created and to be able to sell the green tags or renewable energy certificates for them. And they're having the opportunity to have, as John said, these outside investors that would come take the tax credits, both federal and state. But at the end of the life of the tax credits, then, you know, transfer or flip ownership to either the city or the nonprofit entity would end up owning them, and then, you know, would be able to sort of, you know, have these new resources on board. And so the property tax exemption, as John said, is an ORS 307-175. And there's a section in there that says the section does not apply to property owned or leased by any individual or legal entity whose principal business activity is directly or indirectly the production, transportation, or distribution of energy. And so the thinking is that statute was originally designed to make sure that, you know, larger wind developers or utilities sort of paid their fair share of local property taxes. But what we're looking at here are facilities that are primarily designed for on-site generation and not necessarily for generation to be put out on the grid to either be used by, sold to an electric utility, or sold in the open market. And so what we have proposed is a one-sentence amendment that would create a sub 4 to 307-175 that says alternative energy systems that are designed to primarily offset on-site consumption, such as in net metered systems, are not affected by sub 3 above. And that section 3 is the one I just read to you. It's not applying to.
And that's not in the bill.
That is not,
we don't have that amendment.
That is not yet in the bill.
Okay.
And so, again, if the because we were only scheduled for a public hearing, if the committee wanted to move forward on this, we could have that amendment drafted very quickly.
Let me just say, let me ask you a couple questions in preparation for a statement or comment about it. The tax credits in this bill are not reflected in the governor's budget. Is that right?
That's correct.
And some of them would actually have the effect of reducing net revenue to the state, because they would reduce income tax payments. Is that correct?
Also correct.
Now, I will, the reason I ask the question that way is that there are some activities that look like they cut taxes, but in fact generate opportunities that otherwise wouldn't be taxed anyway.
They actually
have no effect on taxes because they determine whether an event's going to occur or not. But this isn't necessarily in that category, is it, or is it?
If this isn't changed, we will probably not see that investor model come in. We will
right,
not.
But in effect, in this case, some of those costs of development of these projects will be paid for by the state foregoing tax revenues. Called a credit, what we call
Mr. Chair,
it.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Let me just add another point then, and that is that, as you probably know, the budget is extremely tight. And will continue to be until we do something along the lines of House Bill 2530. I mean, that's just the reality of things over the next, at least certainly this biennium, and maybe longer than that. That being the case, any opportunity we have that will allow for development of alternate energy systems that will with renewability that doesn't have a net negative impact on either state or local revenues is something we ought to look at. You've come up with one, I think, that you've just suggested as a possible amendment to the bill. It is possible. I'm not going to prejudge what the committee might do, but it is possible that may be the bill when we're finished. If we can't get funds to pay for these additional tax credits. So I would urge you to go ahead and get going on an amendment to draft something on that and to see if we can do that. Yes, please, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to make sure it was clear that this is for on-site generation only. So it's possible that a solar electric system, a very large one, could go in, and it wouldn't be, and we're not intending it to be, to exempt everything. It would actually be competing with the small one. It would pay the same taxes. So this is only for the small, or not the small, but the on-site generation that Jeff mentioned.
Right, and as I understood the comment, this kind of activity would not occur at all, but for the property tax exemption.
That's right.
Therefore, it has no net impact on property taxes.
That's right.
So that's an important consideration when we look at the kind of budgets that we face. The question always in situations like this is, do we want to spend our money on solar generation, or do we want to spend it on schools, universities, public safety, health care, and so forth? I mean, this committee isn't responsible directly for that answer to that question, but as members, we have to vote on it on the floor, and so that's why I raise it that way. Does that raise any additional questions from members? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, and I would look forward to that amendment. Bill Nesmith and Brandon, it looks like McCarthy. And you two aren't connected, so whoever wants to go first, doesn't matter.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bill Nesmith. I'm an assistant director at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I just have a few brief comments to offer on this bill. We believe this bill has merit and is consistent with our priorities. The bill would complement other priority legislation, including House Bill 2211 and 2212. Implementing this bill would not have a fiscal impact on our agency. Because the bill has a revenue impact and is not in the governor's budget, we've not taken a position on the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
The no fiscal impact is a useful piece of information.
Yes.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Brendan McCarthy. I'm here representing Portland General Electric. And I wanted to just offer myself for any questions about one piece of the bill that we worked with the supporters of the bill to put in, and that is one section relating to the ability of utilities to partner with homeowners primarily to install most likely solar PV or solar thermal hot water heating generation facilities, and then bill the customer through, have the utility pay for it, and bill the customer through their utility bill itself. And as Representative Bruin stated, the purpose of our proposal is really to encourage another subset of persons who might consider installing some distributed generation facility, but because they don't have the availability of funds or what have you to do it, even after they get the tax credit from the state, tax credit from the federal government, ETO funds, there's still a fairly large chunk of cash that they may have to come up with up front. PGE has a clean wind development fund that it's been collecting as part of our green power program. It's dedicated towards development of renewable energy facilities, and we would loan that out on a zero interest loan program that would pay for the bulk of the facility to be installed, and then the homeowner would be responsible just as for paying it back through their utility bill. So they would see their utility bill go down because they'd be using renewable generation at home, and it would go up a little bit by the amount that they owed back for the loan. We think it's a good idea, and we would develop the program and approach the PUC for approval to run the program before it was implemented. And just as a side note, utilities are very interested in this type of distributed generation. It allows us to manage our load much more effectively, whether we own the asset or not. We last summer reached a summer peak of over 4,000 megawatts, putting us very, very close to actually our ability to serve our load. And the more we do this type of thing, the more we're able to really manage those peaks.
Would you repeat that number?
It was about 4,200 megawatts, I think.
which our normal average load is about 2,300 megawatts, so a significant spike.
And you were peaking at the same time as everyone else in the country, I'm assuming.
That was a local peak, but yes, it was summertime. So, and it was we were actually expecting the weather to cool over the weekend, and it did not. The forecasts didn't come out the way they were expecting, and we actually had some Northwest energy generation go offline quite suddenly, and so there was it was a bit tight. And this type of facility would really the more homeowners that do this, that just levels that out.
Yes, thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I wanted to ask the last panel this and didn't, but Brendan seems to know what does PV stand for?
Photovoltaic.
Okay, thank you. I'm not so techno here. I know they're talking about solar energy, but...
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger.
It's your language, I know.
Right.
Silicon that grabs electrons out of the light.
Too much information.
I think. Is what we're talking about. Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Let me ask one. Is that arrangement allowed in this bill?
Representative,
the arrangement that you're describing,
Chair Barnhart, that is our amendment, and
oh, I see,
and it is a revenue neutral for the state, so it's I understand that that's a substantive amendment in a substantive committee, but for the revenue committee, they should understand that this should have no effect on state revenues at all.
Well, and is it in the bill now?
It is.
Oh, it is. It's in the A endorsed version. Oh, I see. So it was your amendment, and it's already in. So it's not a new amendment.
Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you. All right, Section 8. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 3488? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3488, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2500. Is that yours?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2500 expands the EMT personal income tax credit that was created last session to include first responders as defined in the statute. It modifies the time requirement for eligibility from the 20% of volunteer services to a metric of hours, and that would be at least 100 hours in rural areas during the tax year or at least 50 hours during the tax year in a frontier county. And the bill makes the amendments effective for tax years 2008 through 2010. And just by way of history, the 05 legislature created the EMT credit, which is a non-refundable credit of $250 for certain rural emergency medical technicians.
And so it doesn't change the amount. It adds to the number of people who would get it.
Correct.
Thank you. Let's see. I'm just going to go down the list. Scott Eklund, Ed Patterson. And then we'll have another small panel, too. Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Eckblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. As was just mentioned, this is a relatively new program. It came into being during the last legislative session. The Department of Revenue determined that the first tax year for which this program could be used, tax credit program could be used, was tax year 2006. So we have just barely put 1 year's worth of experience under our belt administering the eligibility requirements for this program. One of the problems that we realized with the program as we started to implement it was that we were unwittingly discriminating against people who worked as an EMT in one community and then maybe came home in the evening and volunteered in their own community, because the way it was constructed, the way it's currently constructed, the statute required that you add your paid EMT time to your volunteer EMT time, and from that total, 20% of your time must be volunteer. And so for those who work full-time or more in the field of EMS, you'd have to volunteer an awful lot in addition to your regular job in order to qualify for the tax credit. Also, and the second primary purpose of this bill is to add first responders. In rural communities, and in particular the most rural of rural communities, first responders are equally vital components of the emergency response system. Those are folks who are trained, but have not, are not, yet up to the standards of EMT. So there's EMT basics, EMT intermediates, EMT paramedics. But prior to that sequence is first responders. They're non-transporting emergency personnel. With that, I'm happy to ask any or answer any questions.
Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am the executive director for the Oregon Rural Health Association, which is fitting as an entirely voluntary organization. We have about 750 individual members and about 60 businessmen members. And I think it's fitting that we'd be very supportive of all rural health volunteer activities. Volunteers in the rural parts of the state, I have learned, are the front line of defense, and we want to be as supportive as we can. We're having some problems in recruiting volunteers now in the rural parts of the state, and any incentive that we can create, such as the $250 tax credit, has proven to be very much an incentive, even though the amount is relatively small. So we are very much in support of this bill as it is amended.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. James Oder, Tina Greiner. I mispronounced your name, didn't I?
It's Ader.
Ader. That German diphthong eludes me. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
And would you, for the record, state your name, please?
James Ader with the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters and Leavenworth Fire District. This, as the gentleman before us talked about, recruiting is one of our biggest...
And one more quick interruption. That microphone needs to be further away from you, otherwise it will distort your voice. Thank you.
With the recruiting, it is getting harder to recruit, especially in our rural areas. This is just one small thing that will help us in that. The first responders do have to put in almost as many hours to be certified as what our EMT basics do. So they also put in a lot of time besides what they have to in the field. It's an 8 to 10 week program to get them certified to be able to help respond. But with this, it'll help keep and maintain more. We are seeing that we have more people that want to be EMS and joining the fire service also for the departments that will offer just EMS, and this will help us also in bringing those people in all into the field also.
Thank you.
Tina Greiner with Oregon Volunteer Firefighters, as well as SIO Fire Department and Jefferson Fire Departments. I have to agree with Jim in that first responders are vital to both of my departments. First responder is an introductory 40-hour course, but to maintain your certification is the same amount of hours as maintaining your EMT basic certification, which is over 100 hours for your initial certification. Recert is, I believe, 25 hours every 2 years. I know in the two agencies that I work for SIO and I volunteer for Jefferson, first responders are vital to us. I couldn't do my job as a paramedic without them going out and initially stabilizing the patients. And the amount of hours that they spend training and responding to calls every year, I can think of one off the top of my head in the last 2 months where we would not have a person alive in our district if it weren't for the four first responders who responded with no one else trained. This is a minimal tax. And I think that by allowing the first responders to take advantage of this, that is going to be a great recruitment and retention portion of keeping rural EMS alive.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you folks coming, but if I'm reading this map correctly, neither of you are within qualifying areas.
That's correct. But by us both of us belonging to the Oregon Volunteer Firefighter Association Board. We represent volunteers throughout the state. Besides just fire, we also represent the volunteer EMS service. So it is something that we hold dear to represent all those folks in the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Olson.
James, for Lebanon, I mean, are you having a struggle right now with finding volunteers over there?
Actually, I think we may be one of the exceptions. Right now we're doing two recruitment sessions a year, and we're having about 8 to 10 people each session. So we are the exception that we do see throughout the whole nation even.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2500? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2500 and open a public hearing. Let's see. We're going to stand at ease for just a couple of minutes. We have some people coming at 2 o'clock to be heard on House Bill 3500. So, oh, you're ready? You're ready. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3500.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3500 modifies the pollution control facility tax credit and extends the period for which facilities may be certified for the tax credit. The bill defines enhanced pollution control facility, base pollution controlled facility costs, and environmental enhancement certified costs. It requires the enhanced pollution control facility to be constructed or installed after January 1, 2006, and it extends the application deadline through 2014. And the bill creates a new credit percentage schedule for the enhanced facilities. For these facilities, you have the base costs and the enhanced costs, if you will. And for the base costs, the percentage is 20% in 2008, and it reduces every year to 0% in 2011. And during that same time period, the credit for the enhanced costs increases from 25% to 45%. So there's a switch in where the credit is sourced from the base cost to the enhanced. And it extends the sunset date for the current 35% credit and for the enhanced facilities credit through 2013. The bill requires pollution control facility owners to report on continued operation and effectiveness of the facilities, and it also allows the credit to be transferred to another taxpayer. And you also have in your packet the -2 amendment, which we received today. So I'm not sure exactly what the -2s do yet. I haven't had a chance to go through it.
Thank you. And a quick reading of the -2 suggests that it replaces the bill. So perhaps we're going to hear about that some more today. Okay. I'm going to. It looks like I have 6 people. I'm going to take a panel for, and then a panel against, and then we'll see who else might want to testify today. Lisa Adalto. Oh, actually, a couple more. Lynn Lundquist. A couple more panels than I thought. And did you have a third person with you? No? Go ahead.
Chair and committee, my name is Lisa Adalto, and I'm the Director of Environment and Economic Development for the Oregon Business Association, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. We're pleased to be here to provide testimony on the Oregon Business Association's Environmental Enhancement Tax Credit, the EETC bill. About a year ago, OBA was approached by people from both the environmental community and the business community, and the discussion centered on the PCTC. Individuals from these communities thought that was a useful bill, but it had become very polarized and had also been around for 30 years. They thought that the OBA would be in a good position to find a compromise way of modernizing the bill and to encourage both the environmental and the economic development aspects of the bill. And so we took that on. We spent many months working with both people in the environmental community, people in the business community, to kind of fashion a compromise. And what you see before you is a hybrid bill that represents the work that we've done for almost a year, actually, on this bill. The bill We believe that the bill, if it's enacted into the law, will create numerous benefits for Oregon, including environmental benefits. This bill will stimulate businesses to go above and beyond Oregon state laws. So it'll give businesses an encouragement to reduce or eliminate pollution. This bill will develop new practices to enhance sustainability. This law rewards those pioneer companies who are inventing and investing in new ways to create products and services that reduce pollution, replace toxic materials, reduce waste, and reduce carbon use. As these new practices are developed, Oregon's pioneer companies can sell their expertise and procedures and knowledge and create prosperity for all of Oregon. I have probably personally seen over 40 companies of this sort that are pioneering in these new ways of sustainability. Software companies that can reduce 70% of food waste, vitamin companies that are replacing old plastic containers with corn-based containers. There's a company that you press a button when you leave the house and all your electricity goes dormant. So there's a huge impetus to create this kind of new sustainable product. And we believe that in Oregon we'd like to be a center of that kind of innovation. And so that one of the purposes of this bill is to give the kinds of leg up to that kind of company that's creating and pioneering in these new sustainability procedures. We believe that this bill creates and maintains a partnership between the environmental community and the business community. We've heard many business members of the OBA attest to their pride in creating new sustainable practices and their use of the tax credit which allowed them to do this. We see economic benefits. In some cases, companies have told us they would not be able to stay in Oregon without the kind of assistance that this tax credit provides. And finally, kind of pulling it all together, we believe that this bill will help promote Oregon's competitive advantage as a leader in sustainable practices. Oregon, through its business plan, has determined that Oregon will make this part of our competitive advantage. We have said sustainability is something that's unique to Oregon, and we're going to create the synergy here by attracting expertise, financing, people, young people, Goldman Sachs, money, and products to Oregon all around the concept of sustainability. And we believe that this EETC will help us to that end. And this will then leverage our research dollars. It will help agriculture. It will help forestry. And it will help communities throughout Oregon. The concept of the EETC is to create a hybrid, which gives companies a tax credit for activities that substantially reduce or eliminate pollution. And this, the very specifics about this will be determined through rules. And as part of the bill, we've got a way to pay for the rules making. So this isn't going to be just anything that you dream up. There will be specifics around what that means. There are two pieces, and in your handout, you can see that we have a base pollution control tax credit and an environmental enhancement tax credit. The base credit is defined as a pollution control facility that allows a company to exceed federal standards. The enhanced activities are defined as activities that go above and beyond state or local requirements or include an environmental management plan that guides a company to reduce or eliminate pollution through the employment of new procedures. So it's not necessarily just some piece of equipment that you tag onto the end of a pipe. This would allow a company to look at their procedures and retool and replan or reduce carbon emissions by 40% or 1,000 tons. And you can see that the graph that I presented in my materials is different from the one that's in the original bill, and it represents the dash twos and where we're going with this.
So the dash two is your amendment.
We're still working on it, though. And I did want to say that that is the perfect segue to my next remark.
Thank you.
Which is about the cost. We have designed this to be revenue neutral so that it will not exceed the cost of the previous PCTC. And we're working on that. We're working right now with DEQ and with fiscal to get to that point. So we're, although we have the Dash 2s, they are our amendments. We are fully supportive of them. We'd like to keep, we want to keep looking at our modeling, and we might have a Dash 3 as well. So in conclusion, we've seen a huge interest in this session in environmental practices, renewable energy, and recycling, and we have supported very strongly those efforts and continue to do so. And we laud this this body for being so active with those issues. We believe that the EETC is a necessary complement to those activities. Energy and recycling deserve our passionate attention, but we should not forget that throughout Oregon there are many companies that are manufacturing things and servicing things, and many of those companies need our encouragement as well. Throughout these industries, some new and traditional, there are changes that should and can be made to reduce carbon emissions, reduce pollution, and pioneer more sustainable practices. And we urge that you pass the EETC bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lynn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. I will just start off by correcting just a one word that Lisa said that I saw the chair sort of wince at, and I think I'll clarify that. When we're saying it's revenue neutral, we're not talking about over the long term, but in this biennium and nearly so in the next biennium. And another one who's going to testify will talk more about the specifics of how that happens. But that's the answer, Chair Barnhart, to the little wince that I
Thank
noticed
you.
There. Well, the Oregon Business Association is actually very proud of the fact that we think we played a major role in supporting other organizations as well this session in regard to environmental issues. And actually, we've been in the Environment Committee a good share of the time, and Lisa has done the heavy lifting there, whether it's in the biodiesel, the renewable portfolio standards, even on global warming, sustainability in general. And so that's why we are supportive of this bill today. When Lisa came as a new employee about a year ago, and she talked about that she was some of the things she's going to do, and she started working with, as she indicated, with the other business environmental groups, I wondered at the time, because as you, particularly those of you who've been around a while, know sort of the past history. This is not only just a modifying the old PCTC, I think it's a major revamp. This is a major overhaul on this, and I have one complete new direction, as she's indicated here, with above and beyond. There'll be those that may testify that say, well, you know, you're giving tax credit, a portion of the tax credit for those who only meet the law. I would say that we have already done that, for example, with your renewable portfolio standards. You're enticing businesses to help produce renewables, and that's only to meet the law. I don't think, as long as we keep the proper perspective to that, that that's necessarily negative. We need to be, it's the carrot approach. And this is what this is doing. There's a big carrot in this to help the businesses step forward into uncharted waters. And many of you look around at our business people, and you understand that. So that's what this bill is really all about. I think Lisa did a good job of explaining the details of this. I'll just close by saying this. You know, my mother always told me that whenever you have some little advantage, you need to make sure that the people understand that. And so you've done something, you don't always want to hide it under a bushel. I'm very proud of the fact that the business community stepped forward, and according to the most recent revenue forecast, it's over $300 million that we've stuck into the rainy day fund. Very happy to have that happen. The revenue forecast in this very room with this very committee this morning, what I would glean from that, it simply showcases the fact that we need a healthy economy. We need a business community that's working in a sustainable manner in order to create the resources so that we can provide those essential services, whether it's education, healthcare, whatever it happens to be. So actually, I'm proud of the fact that I think we've had a good session stepping forward, and we see this as sort of a combination that we can be further enticed a little bit with a carrot to help make even greater strides in sustainability than we have in times past. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Our questions for this panel? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, but just a comment.
Please.
OBA is to be complimented for their leadership in this arena. They've gone above and beyond, and so have their members in trying to maintain environmental sustainability. And I would add that in doing so, they've probably created a mechanism by which they're assisting all industry here in the state for branding Oregon as pro-environment. I just think this is not only good for the environment, but this will do handsprings here for economic development in our state in the future. And Lisa's zeal is palpable. It's just great.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony today. I'm going to struggle with the name because I'm not sure I can read it, but I'm going to try. Robert Ferris, John Ledger. Am I close?
Sure.
Wonderful. Gentlemen.
Pleasure to be here. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I am an old hand at this particular issue, as some of you know. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill. And I also want to thank Mr. Lundquist and Ms. Adato for bringing this bill. As you may know, we brought in, everybody agreed this thing had to be rewritten. I mean, it just had to be. And we actually have a bill in the Senate that was sent down by Dr. Bates, and one over here, which was sent down by Representative Boom. And we looked at this one, and we kind of actually liked it better. And OBA was kind enough to kind of take a look at what we did, and we took a look at what they did, and some of the things sort of meshed very well. We think this is a very important bill, and I think I cannot emphasize enough, this is not the old pollution tax credit bill of the past. For many years, what that bill was just a 50% credit no matter what you built. It was wide open, and those were kind of like the good old days. You know? But those have passed, we know that. And this bill has some, it's going to have some really, I think, unique parts to it. One of the things that you need to know about the pollution credits, or whatever you want to call them, is the way you get the credit is quite laborious. This is not a process whereby you promise to do something, you get the credit, and then you may or may not do it. The way the credit works is a facility, someone plans to do something, and it might be they're looking for what state to locate something. More likely, they're looking at what state to close something. And facilities compete within the operations of the company, and the company will often go, we've got some older facilities or whatever, we're gonna combine some, we're gonna close others, and we would very much like them to throw people out of work in Minnesota or Georgia, as opposed to Oregon. And so this is important for a lot of companies. The way the credit works is the company decides, they make a plan on what they want to do, and the credit would play into that because it's the cost of doing business. And then they do their planning, and then they do their building. They build it, and then they get it completed, and then they test it out, and they get it running. And after this device, control device or whatever you have, operation process is up and running, then you can hire an accounting firm, and often an engineering firm, and gin up your application, and then you have a year to get it into the DEQ, and then the DEQ will analyze it. They'll hire somebody on the outside, which you will pay for, and then it will go to the EQC, and then the EQC will approve it or not, and sometimes they don't. And then, once you get it, the award, then you can start using the credit, and you can use 10% of the credit the first year, each year. So in many cases, you're looking for quite a ways from the time you decide to do something to when you can actually use the credit. And you have to do something to get the credit. You have to do it because you have to apply and show that you did it. And one of the interesting things I think that we're going to see come out of this when all is said and done is this has in it provisions when they talked about is going when a company goes beyond federal requirements. About a third to a half of the states in this country have limitations of some type on their books that say the agency shall not pass rules more stringent than those required by the federal government. About a third to a half, and it varies on media and state. We don't have any of that, and we actually don't think it's a good idea. And this, frankly, has made my job much easier. When I go back to my members and the DEQ is going to do new toxic standards, new hazardous air pollution programs not required, whatever it might be, I can go back to my members and say, it's more strict than required by EPA, but remember, you can recover some of your costs. So it levels the playing field a little bit. The other thing this does is that it requires some accountability. And that is whoever gets these credits, one of the things we always hear is, you know, what do you get for it? How do you track it? And every company that gets a credit is annually going to have to report to the DEQ using DEQ forms and criteria what the benefits of receiving that credit were. They have to verify that they're actually still doing what they said they'd be doing, and they have to list the benefits. Might be to the community, might be to the company, whatever it is. The other thing we've done is some of these things in here, like going beyond federal or what, sometimes they're hard to define. We did the best we could in here, but we specifically said that the EQC can do rulemaking to clarify any issues. That kind of keeps everybody, you know, and that will take, everyone will get their say in the rulemaking process. That'll be open to everybody. We will also pay for that with a surcharge on the application fee, so it will not cost the DEQ anything for that. Lastly, this is one which I'm kind of proud of. I was listening in a hearing room, and Ms. Halleck, director of DEQ, was bemoaning the fact that she has programs that are very important, like groundwater protection, and there's no way to get money for them. Because they don't have really a focused interest group, and they don't have a permit. You know, nobody has there's no permit that applies that they can levy a fee on. And so I was home actually doing my mutual funds, and you know how you do, you know how some funds, like what I did before I kind of caught on to no loads, there'd be a front end load on the fund. So what we're proposing here is there'd be a front end load on the credit. And that is a company applies for the credit, and when they get the credit awarded to them, to activate that credit, they would pay to the DEQ 1.5% of the value of the credit. And that money would go into a special account for DEQ groundwater protection. That way the DEQ would start getting a steady flow of money. It would gyrate around, but they'd have a flow of money for an important program that otherwise I don't think would get funded, really never has. And it would be funded by the companies that are enjoying the tax credit. And it would be funded by companies that are doing something special to protect the environment. And the company would calculate that into whether they want to get the credit or not. I mean, that'd be part of the business decision. So what it does then, it gives DEQ another revenue stream for something otherwise is very difficult to protect. And it's financed by people who take that into the calculation of the credit. And so we think we're still working on a lot of this. We need to make sure we get the fiscal down right now because of the saleability of the credits. It kind of is a little higher than we would like. Historically, historically when the credits were running at 50%, the award, at the average annual award was about $20 million. The average cash in was about $13 million, because a lot never get cashed in because the company went broke. Well, you can't carry them forward very long, 2 or 3 years. So if you don't make any money, then you lose it. And of course, if you're going to sell the credits, then that will go up a little bit because the credits won't just languish and die. Some will be sold. Although I think especially for smaller companies that are doing innovative things, that would be very valuable to them because they can use that to develop their business. But we're very interested in this, especially for pulp and paper, metals, businesses that pay good money, and we don't want to lose them. We'd like to attract more. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rob Ferris, and I'm with Ferris Lumber Company. We're located about 25 miles east of here in Lyons in Mill City, Oregon, and we make lumber, veneer, and plywood. And we were established in 1922, so this is our 85th year. And since 1980, we've grown from 100 people to 450 employees and have a payroll of about $16 million. The Pollution Control Tax Credit Program has been invaluable to us over the years. We eliminated two log ponds that were a source of water pollution and went to dry land log handling, and we paved our log yard and were able to get a tax credit for that. And it we were putting hundreds of truckloads of solid waste into landfills, and with that paving of that log yard, we were able to recoup all of that for fuel. We have some trucks that we like to keep clean that run up and down the highway, and we, when we wash them, our soap suds and the road grime and petroleum would end up off of the property in the ditch and in the creek. And we took it upon ourselves to put in a truck and equipment washing station that was that recycles the chemicals that we use and captures all of that and keeps it out of our streams. And this was nothing that was required of us by the DEQ. We bought a bankrupt plywood mill. It's been almost 10 years now, and they were in compliance in all ways, but we put in a bag house to capture fine wood dust, and it just cleaned up our site and improved the air quality in our plant and the surrounding area. And we qualified for a tax credit for that, and annually we pay $20,000 a year to pay for the electricity and maintenance to operate it, and $5,000 to clean the bags every year. But this is another example of using the program for improving the environment, where we've always had a very positive relationship with DEQ, and we try to stay ahead of the game and solve problems before they get bigger. At this plywood plant, we replaced a modest air pollution control device with three new scrubbers, and presently we're embarking on the largest project we've ever engaged in. We're putting in a woody biomass fired power plant, and it's going to require an electrostatic precipitator to keep the particulate out of the air, and it was a very expensive piece of equipment. And this pollution control equipment is just a very integral part in this new boiler and cogen plant. We're going to employ 9 more people at a very high pay scale, and they're really good jobs. And so these are just a few of the examples where we've used this pollution control tax credit, and it's just been a wonderful thing for our community and for our company, and it's made us more competitive in the marketplace over time. And we really appreciate it and would hope that it can be continued.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel, Representative Berger?
Yeah, a couple of comments and maybe a question. Mr. Chair, Mr. Ferris, thank you very much for coming. I think that having you sit here and explain how responsible our industries, Oregon-grown industries, are, it's enough that you employ 450 people with good high-wage jobs that support families, but you also are very aware of the sort of Oregon ethic around this, and I really appreciate hearing this and getting this on the record, because too often in your industry, oh, there are a bunch of polluters who don't care. That is absolutely not the case, and I applaud you for it. Mr. Ledger, the DEQ groundwater piece that you talked about, that is not in this bill, is it?
It will be in the amendments.
Have you talked to I have a little discomfort about that, because the very people that are going to be coming to you for this kind of a credit are the very people that you want to encourage, not discourage. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not sure that I like the hydraulic of that. You're asking
them. Pretty good. It's groundwater.
Yeah, right. I'm glad you caught that. But what I'm talking about is that you're asking them to do more when you're already asked. They're already being asked to do a lot. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you know, that's not a sink or swim piece. I can tell you that it came about, and some of you know, I was deputy director for DEQ under Cecil Landris. Many years ago. And there are some things that, I mean, are worth doing, and it was just a small flash of misplaced creativity, you know. But it just seemed like a good thing to do, and I actually think DEQ does a very good job, and they need the money. But this is not something we have to have. I mean, certainly my members will not complain if it's not in there. I just thought it would be some way to help the do something else to help the environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring that up, not that I'm trying to kill it. It's just that I would hate to have it killed over a piece like that. Some good ideas. And. Yeah. Mr. Chair, one other thing. This is my third round with pollution control tax credits, and in the past, the DEQ staff has provided the Revenue Committee with an updated list on who is on the PCTC and in what amounts, and I would sure appreciate as we pursue that the committee be provided with that information.
We can certainly ask. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, one thing that does change quite a bit on this is no chippers.
I understand.
The one exception, the chippers were like 1% of the total money, but they were like 80% of the applications. We left in chippers over 100 horsepower because rather than piling stuff up and torching it off when people clear land, we'd like them to chip it and use it for various things. So all those, as you know, as I tell everybody, all those friendly little suburban chippers, like you saw in the movie Fargo, well, no, the Fargo chippers are gone.
May I?
For the record, conflict of interest, my husband bought such a chipper. He didn't know about the pollution control tax credit. He did not take it. He tried to give it away to my son-in-law. Couldn't. It still sits unused and untax credited in our garage. Anybody wants a chipper, talk to me.
Also, no credits for noise that came out. Just a lot of things came out.
I will say that the large chippers are something that we're going to need to grind up the material that we bring out of the woods, say the topsoil of the trees, address the fire hazards that we have in our forests. We'll want to bring some of that in. We'll have to grind it up to a uniform size to be able to transport it into the plant, and that's $500,000. I mean, it can be an awful lot of money to get set up to do that sort of thing. But I would like to tell you that the agency is in their auditing, they're quite judicious with the public money. For example, when we put in our scrubbers, we didn't get a tax credit for the ducting that brings the gases to the scrubber, which, you know, my cousin who was filling it out thought it should be, but that's an example. And we had an audit on our bag house, and there were things that were taken away that we thought qualified, but didn't. So I just want to let you know that there are people watching the tax dollars closely.
And it does include process changes now. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Ferris represents a significant portion of the Oregon employer community that chooses to go vastly above and beyond minimum requirements, and they are truly committed to trying to do a good environmental job here in the state of Oregon, and just like to recognize those efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative, and thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it. And now I would like to hear from Jeremiah, Andrea, and Liz. And I'm sorry, some of the last names are hard for me to read, so I'll let you come up that way.
Good hire members?
Liz. Frankel?
Frankel?
Yes.
There are model business.
Thank you. Well, you know, it seems that when people print their names, they print their first names more clearly than their last names. That's been my experience. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. Again, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Osberg, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I would like to actually start out by thanking the Oregon Business Association. They have really, I think, contributed to healthy debate this session. As one of the organizations that I think for a long time has sort of been tarred with the debate about the environment versus the economy, I think having the support of the Oregon Business Association for good environmental policy has helped reinforce the message that good environmental policy can be good business policy and good economic policy as well. I'd also like to point out that they have indeed come up with a proposal that is significantly improved in terms of being a targeted tax credit with more specific purposes and not as open-ended and not as much paying companies to comply with any law that is on the books as the existing pollution control tax credit program. That said, Osberg does oppose the current proposal for the new version of the pollution control tax credit, and that's for one very specific reason, which is that we do not think it is either good environmental or good economic policy to offer tax credits to companies for complying with environmental standards and policies, whether state or federal. And that's for a couple of reasons. The primary reason is simply it is actually has to do as much to do with economics as it has to do with environmental protection. There's a big reason that environmental protection so often requires regulatory approaches, and that is simply that the way the economy generally works in the absence of environmental regulations or standards is that the environmental consequences of a company's activity aren't accounted for in their costs. So the market can't really solve the problem because it costs the same. Choosing to address an environmental problem might only increase the company's costs, and so therefore it could give them a competitive disadvantage. Setting environmental standards and policies levels the playing field so that everybody has to meet the same environmental costs of doing business. That not only is necessary for protecting the environment, but it actually also lets the free market work for bigger picture environmental protection, and that's for this reason. If several companies are generating a lot of pollution, the environmental standards require them to pay the consequences of that pollution, to reduce the pollution, to mitigate the pollution, depending on whatever the case may be. If they're required to do that, then a company can actually gain an economic advantage by making process or other manufacturing changes that reduce the amount of pollution being generated to begin with. So they can reduce their cost of compliance by changing what they're doing. In other words, the free market can at that point then actually aid environmental progress because everybody has to account for the costs of their environmental consequences. So that's kind of a fundamental piece about why environmental regulation is so often what we're talking about. When a tax credit means that the government starts paying a company to comply with environmental standards, it removes the ability for the free market to incent people to actually do a better job complying or find cheaper ways of reducing their environmental impact because the government's paying the cost for reducing the environmental impact. So that's kind of the fundamental issue we have with paying for compliance with environmental laws. There are a couple of other pieces. There's a fairness issue. There aren't very many other arenas of the law where people in Oregon are paid to comply with the law. I think it also sets up a specific dynamic where the state then faces increased costs every time we increase or improve our environmental standards. This, I think, causes particular problems when you focus that tax credit on places that, where the state exceeds federal standards. The reality is Oregon wouldn't have some of the country's first limits on global warming pollution from new cars and trucks if we weren't willing to exceed federal standards for environmental issues. We wouldn't have our bottle bill. There would be no Federal Clean Air Act if other states hadn't decided to take clean air on their own shoulders. Exceeding federal standards is an incredibly important tool for finding appropriate environmental solutions, and I don't think it sends a very good signal that the state decides taxpayers will pay every time the state wants to have the right environmental policy in place. Let me wrap up by talking specifically about some of the renewable energy tax credits, as somebody who was here moments ago arguing for renewable energy tax credits for companies. I think there's a fundamentally different situation when you're talking about energy for a couple of reasons. One is simply that renewable energy tax credits primarily, not universally, but primarily aren't going to the company that is regulated by an energy policy. If you look, for example, at the proposed renewable energy standard requiring utilities to invest in renewable energy, well, they are eligible for some of the tax credits. The tax credits are largely and primarily aimed at the businesses and consumers around Oregon who can make other choices that the utility is not in a position to make regarding their own use of renewable energy or energy conservation technologies. There's also just a fundamental difference, which is that the energy market is very, very, very far removed from a free market. It's a heavily regulated monopoly where utilities are required to offer services. Their costs are regulated by the government. And every cost a utility accrues is passed on to customers through the rate-making procedures, either at the PUC for investor-owned utilities or for the publicly-owned utilities or consumer-owned utilities. There is no profit, so all the costs go to the consumer owners of that utility. That also means the tax benefits and the tax credit for utility also get passed through to the customers, who are also the taxpayers. So it's just a fundamentally different dynamic when you're talking about the energy industry as a whole, which is why we see it a little bit differently than a tax credit that could go to any company for complying with an environmental law. I'll stop there and see if anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Durbin. I'm the Executive Director with Oregon Environmental Council. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to register some of our concerns with House Bill 3500. The Oregon Environmental Council has opposed the pollution control tax credit for many years on the grounds that it doesn't make fiscal sense and rewards companies for following environmental laws. While HB 3500 is a modified version of the pollution control tax credit, we've taken a position to oppose this bill for several reasons. First, it's not the most effective means to reduce pollution and safeguard environment and public health. PCTC is focused on paying businesses to come into compliance with the law, whether it be federal, state, or local law, and our position has always been that we are not in favor of tax credits for action required by law. Second, while this bill tries to take the next step and provide incentives to companies for going above and beyond the law, it fails to actually set out a strategy for pollution reduction. There are many kind of approaches that could be taken, such as prioritizing pollution reduction that benefits public health, reducing the most significant risks to public health. But there's no strategy here. Instead, the enhancement side of this bill takes a very haphazard approach. The criteria is very loose and vague. For example, would a company receive a tax credit to plant some extra trees, put up solar panels, plant an eco-roof? It was mentioned by an earlier panelist that it's an opportunity to help companies develop carbon reduction plans. I think it's important for the committee to know that companies that have developed these carbon reduction plans are actually saving their companies a lot of money, in fact millions for some, depending on their size. So does that warrant an additional tax credit for doing so? All of these actions are important and could be argued reduce pollution and enhance the environment, but really, do they really deserve a tax credit to make it happen? And is this the most effective use of our state's resources to safeguard the environment? We don't think so. And, of course, an important question for the committee is the cost. Since its inception, the state has spent well over $730 million on the program. And for the last 10 years, 60% of the tax credit dollars went to just five companies. For 2005 to 2007, the estimated fiscal impact is nearly $25 million. We would argue that there's a much better use of these state funds. The $25 million in taxpayer dollars dedicated to PCTC this biennium is double the amount of general fund dollars the governor asked for in his budget to restore the DEQ's capacity to protect Oregon's air, land, and water. It is far more than the $14 million needed to reduce and prevent diesel pollution, our state's number one air toxic that imposes $2 billion in public health costs each year. And it dwarfs the $1.8 million called for to monitor and reduce toxics in the Willamette watershed. And this program won't address issues in Oregon's other important watersheds like the Deschutes, Rogue, and Columbia. $25 million could be better invested in these targeted outcomes-based approaches to pollution reduction and prevention, not more vague and arbitrary tax breaks that would disproportionately benefit the largest industries. We appreciate the efforts of Oregon Business Association, AOI, and the Northwest Environmental Business Council to craft a bill that tries to improve PCTC. In fact, we worked very hard with these groups to come up with an alternative to PCTC. But unfortunately, the bill before us today is not a significant enough improvement and raises many questions given its vagueness and lack of accountability to clear outcomes in improving our environment. Given that, we oppose HB 3500. Oregon should join the long list of other states across the nation who have gotten rid of this program and not replace it with something that's essentially the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please.
The League is a curious organization because we have three arms.
I'm sorry. Would you introduce yourself?
Oh, excuse me. Liz Frankel, League of Women Voters.
Thank you.
The League has three arms. We have a governance and good government arm. We have a social policy and human resources arm. We have a natural resources arm. I typically do the natural resources, so most people look at me and think, aha, environmental. Well, in this particular case, I'm representing the entire League. I always am, but in this case, it's more important. And Jeremiah's speech sort of brought this subject up. Okay, he's arguing in the first place no tax credits, and then he's arguing for tax credits, and he did a great job in justifying that. The League has come to the conclusion, and this has, we came to this conclusion actually during the special session, where we saw what was happening was robbing Peter to pay Paul out of, you know, you take money away from the poor folks and give it to the kids that couldn't walk, and or you take the money away from the kids that couldn't walk and give it to the kids that couldn't read, or you'd rob parks. It was clear there was a problem, and of course one of the problems is money. And we looked, and that wonderful book that comes out once a year that all you legislators get for the tax expenditures, and we went through that. One of the conclusions we drew was tax expenditures add up to a big chunk of funds, and that's money lost. In other words, if we didn't give all those tax expenditures, we'd have that money to spend by the state. Well, then what do you do about it? Clearly, it isn't a simple process. First of all, it isn't easy to figure out whether any given program is doing exactly what you intended to have it do. It's not easy to determine, is that a good public purpose? It isn't easy to tell, is that actually working? I mean, there are a lot of glitches in this analysis. Point being, we thought that what we need in this state, and we are turning down lots of bills, opposing them for this reason, we would like to see a commission, some kind of organization that would look at this whole process and figure out a way that we could make tax credits accountable and fair so that all these people could get what we wanted. And this is not easy. It has to start somewhere. It certainly isn't going to begin by extending programs such as the Pollution Tax Credit Program without any other analysis. We're just looking at that all by itself. The League, for example, will support and probably would support lots of low-income housing, which needs support. But how are we to decide that that's better than this wonderful environmental program that they're talking about? So you can read what the League formally says, and basically we oppose this bill, and we are opposing all of the tax credit type programs like this, simply because we think it's time for the state to do what it should have done some time ago and look at this as a whole issue, tax expenditures.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Broome?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
First of all, thank you all three of you for your testimony. I thought it was excellent. But Jeremiah, I won't even begin to touch on the irony of the same day that you're advocating for the tax credits on one. And says, the points that all three of you make about the inherent lack of fairness, if you will, that we're basically paying Oregon Industries to abide by the law, whereas where else can you find that example in Oregon where we're paying people to abide by, you're driving the speed limit, we're going to pay you to do that. I understand that, but what I've always struggled with, we know the pollution control tax credit has an abundance of problems, always has, but what I've always struggled with those sort of who say it needs to go away or we shouldn't have any alternative to this is how we is perhaps a neglect, I don't want to overstate it, but a neglect of where Oregon started and where we are in Oregon. Oregon didn't start with the technologies and the scientific knowledge that we have in 2007. Oregon started 150 years ago as a natural resource-based state, evolved into a honestly a heavy industry manufacturing state, and that's really the bread and butter of the state. Although we're transitioning to those industries of tomorrow, it's a transition that I think is a welcome transition, but we still have really the origins of Oregon, and that remains a critically important part of Oregon. And so what's happened, you've got this, 150 years of Oregon industry, and you basically have, in my opinion, humbly, is that you've got environmental laws that are a really recent phenomenon. Even if we're talking two or three decades now, in the larger scheme of things, they're a relatively recent phenomenon. And in my mind, it's a unique pressure on those old line Oregon industries, natural resource based industries, manufacturing based industries, to try to comply with these new environmental laws that may be absolutely appropriate, in most cases are appropriate, without giving them sort of a smoothing transition. Now, the pollution control tax credit was, hey, we're going to pay you to abide by the law. And, I understand that maybe in 2007 that's not perfect, but it was a start. Now we're to a phase now whereas we're going to pay you for abiding by the law, but we're going to do a little more for you if you actually exceed the law. And then maybe the next step, maybe it's 5 years from now, maybe it's 10 years from now, we're only going to sort of help you if you exceed the law. And I think that's a smooth transition to help what's been 150 years of Oregon industry sort of come into context with new environmental laws. So that's the problem I have with where your position is. Love to hear your comments on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brune, I think I agree with everything you're saying. I think that makes sense. And that's partially why I limit our opposition is to the part of the proposal that would offer the subsidy for complying with laws. If it were limited to the parts of the proposal that are for going beyond environmental laws, we would certainly be looking back to reconsider our position. And as I was telling some other folks who were asking earlier today, could very well be neutral or supportive, depending on what exactly was being proposed. It's certainly not our position that, I guess to oversimplify, big companies should get government money for doing good things. That is quite the opposite. Energy is actually kind of a useful example because we have a whole range of various incentives, both tax credits and then incentive programs run by the Energy Trust using monies collected from energy ratepayers that incentivize a whole range of activities. The vast majority are for not tied to any kind of environmental compliance, but rather are actually specifically targeted to help build the market to the point where the standards can get stronger. So if you look just, for example, at energy efficient appliances and energy conservation measures, you can get tax credits and energy trust incentives for buying an energy efficient furnace, for example, until the state or federal government raises the standard for how efficient all furnaces have to be, and then the incentive also gets higher. I think there's a rule of thumb that some of the policymaking bodies use that they try to have those tax credits be for products that are at least 10% or maybe it's 20% better than the standards of what's on the market. So there's actually a good way to use incentives and tax credits to help push kind of the next generation of leadership and innovation, and then it actually creates a good environment to bring the standards in so that everybody gets up to the same level. And so that, I think, type of program could be designed. Our position on this bill is simply we don't see that type of program in this bill, and so we can't support it for that reason.
Representative Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Brune, I think, probably made the point that I was seeking, but I'm curious about kind of my own consistency here in advocating for social good. I take a look at my own advocacy for universal health care coverage. It benefits the individual, but I'm not at all bashful about asking for socialized costs, because I think there is a great social benefit by achieving that. So my question is then, would it not be consistent for me to be an advocate for these kinds of tax credits for those who, while I agree, as you've argued, we perhaps shouldn't be giving tax credits for people who obey the law. But there is certainly a social benefit to be derived here, particularly as Representative Bruhn points out, if we were to target that to those who exceed minimum criteria, go over and above, as we heard from Mr. Frers, that while the benefits accrue to the individual, in this case an individual company, is there not an argument that that society benefits to the point that maybe recognizing that Mr. Frers and others do an exceptionally good job, that that little bit of recognition and encouragement may merit our participation in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, and also in response to Representative Bruhn's question, I think the issue is clearly there's a societal benefit for companies going above and beyond the law. I think from my perspective, I think the bigger question is at what point and how do you kind of use these incentive programs to leverage the most significant benefit for the public generally? And clearly we're dealing in a situation where we have finite opportunities, finite dollars and revenue to kind of provide those incentives. So what's really the most significant way to really maximize that and leverage that change? And just to be clear, I mean, we, Oregon Environmental Council put in a lot of time and energy to kind of come up with a solution to the PCTC. And unfortunately, because this bill kind of melds the old with a little bit of the new, it's not really something that we are in a position to support. But we do think that the environmental enhancement side of this is worth developing further. I think I can certainly see, for example, looking at kind of both water quality, you know, air quality issues, for example, looking at mercury, benzene, and diesel particulate emissions, three of the greatest threats to public health in the state, you know, tying those incentives to companies going above and beyond the law for reducing emission impacts in those areas. I think there are ways that you can craft this that would help channel a broader societal benefit than what's been done today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And we're moving to our last witness, Joan Snyder, let me simply say that I really appreciate the comments that Ms. Prinkle made about the lack of a system for which to make these decisions. And I think that goes with the comment also, the last comment that was made. We don't, in our legislature, have a good system set up for dealing with making those kinds of comparison decisions. Thank you. And let's hear from our last witness.
Mr. Chair.
We're past our time, so we'd ask you to be brief if you can. Thank you. Yes, sir. Representative Olson.
I just want to follow up with what you said. I would be very interested in Section 8 because it describes a couple different things that DEQ is responsible for doing. One is I'd be very interested in knowing what the form looks like that a taxpayer, you know, submits to them to obtain this. I would also want to know what their measurement is in regards to that, and if they do have some type of a program that's involved with all this too. I would find that interesting.
You're talking about Section 8 of the -2 amendment?
Yep.
Or
Section 2-8.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, I'm Joan Snyder. I'm from Multnomah County. I'm sort of here in two capacities. I'm a practicing environmental lawyer, so I've been advising businesses in environmental matters for over 20 years. I'm also a member of the Northwest Environmental Business Council, which is a trade group of environmental consultants and environmental technology providers who were the ones who were on the cutting edge of developing new environmental technologies that they hope to market not only in Oregon, but nationwide and globally. And NEBC also works closely with a number of our research institutions where we've had discussions. For instance, NEBC was one of the proponents of adding environmental technology development to the sustainability sector of the Oregon Business Plan. And we worked with all the universities in the state in talking about how that concept could be brought forward, how we could focus our efforts in developing Oregon, not just as an environmentally friendly state that values environmental compliance and our environment, but also one that is the sort of hotbed for the development of the new technologies that are going to be needed in the world going forward. And, you know, as I've been talking to people about this, one of the things that I focus on is the issue of nanotechnology. And I think it's great that the legislature got behind ONAMI and supported nanotech in Oregon. But frankly, I think Oregon got on that boat about 5 years too late, and Massachusetts and Chapel Hill and a number of other Texas basically beat the state to the punch. And if you look at where we are in terms of research dollars that are coming in as funding for nanotechnology in Oregon, ONAMI is doing great. And, you know, I'm very proud of that sector. But we weren't at the cutting edge of that. And so part of this bill is about making Oregon at the cutting edge of environmental technology development. So I guess there's two things I want to say, and then I've given you my written comments, so I won't repeat those, and I'll address some of the issues that have come up as others have testified. One, the first point is, this is my perspective as an environmental lawyer. When I deal with clients who are making decisions on environmental technologies to put in place, I'm generally working with an engineer or a consultant who's saying, okay, for your baghouse, here's what you have to do to comply with the existing air quality criteria. For an extra $200,000, you could do that plus something more. And they're sitting there trying to make that fiscal decision, knowing that their product is going to be more expensive if they spend that extra $200,000. It's not required by law. And so my friends at NEBC who sell these technologies or are working on advising the businesses would really like to be able to say, look, you're still going to have to pay more to get this added benefit to the environment and to the public, but you can get at least a 25% tax credit or a 50% tax credit for doing it. So it's going to cost you something, but it's not going to cost you the full load. And I guess it goes to really what Andrea was saying is, you know, OEC and I know OSFERC support the beyond compliance portion of this bill, and if we can create an incentive that puts Oregon in the front of that, then that would set the state apart. And there are other states that have still remnants of the PCTC as it used to exist before this bill. But there's none that has an environmental enhancement tax credit of the concept that we've envisioned here. So that is a way to put Oregon at the front. And then if I think about you know, how it would play out in terms of what could happen in the state, there are concrete examples that are NEBC members. One of them is Stormwater 360, who's developed a media that's used for filtering stormwater made up of compost material. It's, you know, it's not hard science, but it's, you know, it didn't take a lot to invent. They now have sold that portion of the company. They started with 20 employees in Gresham. They now have 85 or something. So there's a huge business economy that's growing because of this developing sector. One thing that that helped them is that the city of Portland has a stormwater manual that requires a new development to use some kind of stormwater control. But none of the existing development is required to use it. So if there was an incentive to say, you know, you can add this technology to what you already have in your existing structures, and there'll be a little bit of a tax credit to incentivize you to do it, it would greatly increase business for companies like that. On the issue of accountability, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, we have included in this bill something that's new, and that is that there will have to be a report to the legislature from each entity who is getting the tax credit of what has actually been accomplished in terms of reduction of pollution or management of pollution each time that they file to get their 10% of the tax credit. And on the issue of the form, we could get Maggie Van De Hey from DEQ to provide the current form. Now, it would be a little bit different for this because there's going to have to be different criteria that get applied, particularly on the environmental enhancement side. And I do want to focus on the environmental enhancement side because if you listen to Jeremiah and Andrea, you will assume this is just a regurgitation of the old PCTC. It's not at all. That is the lesser part of this bill. Ultimately, at least under the Dash 2 amendments, and these numbers keep shifting, but the old kind of pollution control tax credit, first of all, it used to be for any kind of environmental technology. Under this bill, it will only be for technology that goes beyond federal law. So it's basically saying to someone who's making a decision do I stay in Oregon or do I move into Oregon, we can say, okay, our laws are more stringent than Ohio's, but there is a tax credit that helps the businesses that choose to locate here. So that's the base piece. But that ultimately will be only a 25% credit. It's the environmental enhancement component and the environmental management system development cost that will end up being a 50% tax credit. So it is truly a phase out of the old PCTC as we knew it and a phase in of this incentivizing environmental enhancement credit. And Andrea was concerned, and I understand it, with having some kind of bounds on how far this tax credit can go. I would urge the committee to not think about making that too strict, because what we're trying to encourage is innovation. The way the bill is set up right now, the Environmental Quality Commission will be charged with establishing rules where those can be honed out, and OEC can be there, and OSPR can be there, and we can all talk about it. But I don't think that's quite the right thing to do legislatively.
Thank you, and that will have to be the last word. The public hearing on House Bill 3500 is closed, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.